Acts chapter 23. I'm calling this study just because I like to have a label on it for when people go online and look at the studies, they have an idea about, at least some kind of an idea about what this chapter contains, since we just study verse by verse, chapter by chapter. And I've called this Full Circle because we're going to see Paul finally getting to do something that he's been praying about and preparing for and desiring to do for almost 20 years. Have you ever desired to do something for that long of a period of time and gone over the scenario in your mind 1,000 times? Well, when I get there, when I see them, this is what I'll say. I don't know if you've ever been in that situation. It's impossible to explain the feeling of when you finally get to do that and you fail. 20 years. Successful at things that were lesser in your mind. And then the one thing that you've waited 20 years to do. You pour your whole heart into it and it falls flat on its face. Impossible to explain how deflating that is. Mighty strong people in their faith in God have crumbled under such circumstances. We get to see in this chapter tonight how Jesus deals with somebody who's experiencing that. One of my favorite verses, I will freely admit I'm going to get a lot of mileage out of one verse. We've got some gigantic rabbit trails with auxiliary rabbit trails going off of them tonight as well. But just to bring you up to speed, since it's been about 3.5-4 weeks that since we've done this, Paul finally got to go back to Jerusalem right after his conversion, begging, arguing with God to please let him speak to the people, the Pharisees, the Sanhedrin, his cronies, the guys that he used to hang out with. Please, please, I understand them. I used to be like them. Please, I'm the perfect person to tell them about Jesus. And Jesus said, no. In fact, Jesus said, get out of town now, because they're not ready. Not you, not now, not them. I have something else for you to do. So, I don't know if you've ever been in that kind of situation, but he argued, but he did obey. So, that was 20 years before the moment that we're looking at right now. And he's been wildly successful in taking the gospel and telling his story of how Jesus changed his life all over the civilized world. Now here he comes back towards Jerusalem. This is his chance. One sticky wicket all the way down along the Mediterranean, all the way back to Israel. Every time he stops to encourage a church, somebody with the gift of prophecy says, it's not going to go the way you think. You're going to get beat up. You're going to get arrested. It's going to be horrible. Now, they all assumed that God was trying to stop him from going. We've looked at this in great detail in the chapters before this, that he felt compelled by the Holy Spirit to do it anyway, even though he knew what was waiting ahead for him. I just want to pass one little thing out. It occurred to me last night when I was teaching up in Rockland that we sometimes feel like a failure. I know I do. Feel like a failure at the wrong time. We feel like a failure because we have a different expectation of the way it's going to go than the way God thinks it's going to go. And by the way, he's right. He knows the future. If God knows it's not going to work, and you give it all of your heart, thinking that perhaps it will work, then when it doesn't work, you didn't fail. I find those words really liberating. He does know the end from the beginning. So the last time we saw Paul in chapter 22, he tried. You can just see, polished his sermon for 20 years. Okay, I won't do theology. I'm not going to debate. I'm just going to tell him what Jesus did for me. I personally think that's always the best policy. It's very hard to refute. They may not believe you, but, you know, it's really hard to refute that kind of an approach. So he came, and he had a captive audience of the very people that he'd waited all these years to tell. He told his story, how he met Jesus, what kind of a person he was, what kind of a person he became when Jesus came into his life. And he got as far as telling the story of, you guys, I wanted to do this 20 years ago, and Jesus wouldn't let me. He said, you weren't ready. So he sent me somewhere else. He sent me to tell the good news to Gentiles. And the minute he said those words, a riot broke out. And it was so serious that the Romans, who didn't understand Aramaic, which he was speaking in, could not figure out why the crowd suddenly was trying to kill him. And the Romans came in and rescued him. And of course, we pointed out 3 weeks ago, or 4 weeks, whenever that was, that the church abandoned him. The church in 20 years had gone from a bold, spirit-filled, tell the truth and let the chips fall where they may group of people to people who were more concerned with political expediency and traditionalism and not making waves, so that when Paul showed up and Paul did what he did, they abandoned him. In fact, there's only one person that didn't abandon him, and that was Jesus. We're going to get to watch Jesus' plan unfold. And I said this, I think, last time. We only think it's a plan if it looks like a plan. And if it doesn't look like a plan, we think there's no plan. But see, God's never been hung up with that. He thinks thoughts we don't think. What he thinks of as a perfect plan looks like chaos to us until it's over. And when it's over, then we tell him how brilliant he was. Everything that Paul had desired in his heart to do that was prompted by God, it happened. It just didn't happen the way that he thought it would, and it certainly didn't happen without bumps in the road. So last time we saw the Roman commander step in, arrested Paul, beat him up, and then asked what he'd done wrong. Typical police state mentality. And Paul addressed him in Greek, and that sort of blew the guy away. And he says, oh, you speak Greek? And Paul says, basically, yeah, I'm a Roman citizen. And then the commander panicked because it was illegal to do such things to a Roman citizen without due process of law. So the commander freaks out, and he takes Paul into protective custody. And that's where we pick up the story. In verse 30 of chapter 22. And I'm going to read all the way through the end of chapter 23, although I'm positive we won't get that far. The next day, since the commander wanted to find out exactly why Paul was being accused by the Jews, he released him and ordered the chief priests and all the Sanhedrin to assemble. And then he brought Paul and had him stand before them. Now, here's an amazing plan unfolding. These guys hated Paul. Paul wasn't allowed to speak to them. But now they're all forced to get together by the Romans, who don't have a clue what's going on. So who's in control? And Paul looked straight at the Sanhedrin and he said, my brothers, I have fulfilled my duty to God in all good conscience to this very day. And at this, the high priest Ananias ordered those standing near Paul to strike him on the mouth, literally punch him in the face. And then Paul said to him, why, God bless you, Mr. High Priest. No, Paul said, God will strike you, you whitewashed wall. I could have thought of a lot better insults myself. I mean, I think that's a pretty weenie insult, but it's the best you could come up with. You sit there to judge me according to the law, and yet you yourself violate the law by commanding that I be struck. It was against the law to hit anybody in that assembly, no matter what they said. And those who were standing near Paul, verse 4, said, "You dare to insult God's high priest?" And immediately the sound you hear is Paul backpedaling. And he says, "Brothers, I didn't realize that he was the high priest. It is written, do not speak evil about the ruler of your people." So Paul basically apologizes. He reacted in his flesh, which is not a real good idea. Do these circumstances sound remotely familiar? This exact same thing happened to Jesus. Same punching in the face, different high priest, but same Sanhedrin. But Jesus' reaction was completely different. I do understand Paul. I mean, I'm sure I would have reacted the same way and have. But the Lord reminded me when I was feeling pretty good about myself by looking at Paul's reaction. He says, "Son, I'm supposed to be your model, not Paul." So all of a sudden I didn't feel so good about myself. Paul replied, "Brothers, I didn't realize that he was the high priest." Then Paul, knowing that some of them were Sadducees and the others Pharisees, by the way, bitterly opposing theological belief systems in the same governing body, he said, "My brothers, I'm a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee, and I stand on trial because of my..." Immediately, he's divided the group right there. It's like going into Congress and saying, "I'm a Republican, the son of a Republican, and it's the Democrats that are accusing me." That's exactly the effect that it had. Since he knew he wasn't going to get a fair trial, I think it was kind of brilliant. The Romans were clueless to the way this whole body operated, but Paul knew. He used to be part of it. So he said, "I stand on trial because of my hope in the resurrection of the dead." And when he said this, a dispute broke out between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. Now, Luke adds in his narrative here in verse 8, parenthetically, "The Sadducees say that there's no resurrection, and that there are no angels, no spirits, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all." There were other issues, but that was their primary bone of contention. There was a great uproar, verse 9, "And some of the teachers of the law who were Pharisees stood up and argued vigorously. 'We find nothing wrong with this man,' they said. 'What if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him?'" Remember, the last time he tried to address them, he talked about Jesus, the guy that they had all seen put to death. He talked about Jesus knocking him off his horse on the way to Syria to persecute Christians, the living Jesus, blinding light, voice from heaven, very Mosaic circumstances. And this Pharisee is saying, What if it really was? What if it really happened? What if he's not making it up? And the dispute became so violent that the commander was afraid Paul would be torn to pieces by them, and he ordered the troops to go down and take him away from them by force and bring them into the barracks. So here's the second time Paul's been taken into protective custody. Folks, these are the religious leaders of an entire nation. Wouldn't give you very much confidence, would, in your leadership, if they're not only trying to kill you, they're trying to kill each other. And verse 11 is just one of my favorite scriptures in the book of Acts. This is the lowest point in Paul's life. He's finally got to do the thing that he wanted to do for 20 years. He was absolutely convinced it was going to work. It didn't work. And he's sitting here deflated and defeated. And verse 11 says, "The following night, the Lord stood near Paul and said, 'Take courage As you have testified about me in Jerusalem, so you must also testify in Rome. That was another thing he wanted to do. He wanted to go to Rome. The Amplified Bible says, as you have faithfully testified. It's like Jesus is saying, I know you're discouraged. I know you didn't think it was going to go this way. But you did it, buddy. 20 years, you've been wanting to do it. You did it. You told them the truth about me. I told you it wasn't going to work. But you did it. I'm proud of you. And you're going to go to Rome as well. Wayne pointed out last night that it's a good thing that Jesus said those words because of what happens next. The next morning, the Jews formed a conspiracy and bound themselves with an oath not to eat or drink until they had killed Paul. More than 40 men were involved in this plot. And they went to the chief priests and elders and said, we've taken a solemn oath not to eat anything until we've killed Paul. Now then you and the Sanhedrin petition the commander to bring him before you on pretext of wanting more accurate information about his case, and we're ready to kill him before he gets here. But I always circle the phrase, but God, or but the Lord, because people make their plans, they do their thing, and God has his ways. I call this next verse the nephew factor. Here's 40 crazy people sworn that they're going to starve to death or kill Paul, and all God needs is one nephew to foil their plot. But when Paul's nephew heard of this plot, he went into the barracks and he told Paul. And then Paul called one of the centurions and said, take this young man to the commander. He has something to tell him. And so he took him to the commander. And the centurion said, Paul, the prisoner sent for me and asked me to bring this young man to you because he has something to tell you. And the commander took the young man by the hand, drew him aside, and said, what is it you want to tell me? I like this guy. I like this commander. Even when he doesn't know all the facts, he's still trying to do the right thing. And he's starting to suspect he can't really trust these people. I love that he's respecting this young man's secrecy. I love that he even granted this request. So he said, what do you want to tell me? And Paul's nephew, verse 20, says, the Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul before the Sanhedrin tomorrow on the pretext of wanting more accurate information about him. Don't give in to them because more than 40 of them are waiting in ambush for him. They've taken an oath not to eat or drink until they've killed him. They are ready now, waiting for your consent to their request. The commander dismissed the young man and cautioned him, don't tell anyone that you've reported this to me. I like that guy. And then he called two of his centurions and ordered them, get ready a detachment of 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen. Do the math, 470 guys to escort one little skinny bald-headed rabbi who the soldier still doesn't understand what he's done that has caused such an uproar. He just knows he's a Roman citizen. So he says, take him and go to Caesarea at 9 tonight. Provide mounts for Paul so that he may be taken safely to Governor Felix. And then he wrote a letter. Claudius Lysias to His Excellency Governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews, and they are about to kill him. They were about to kill him, but I came with my troops and rescued him, because I learned that he's a Roman citizen. I wanted to know why they were accusing him, so I brought him to their Sanhedrin, and I found that the accusation had to do with questions about their law, but there was no charge against him that deserved death or imprisonment. And when I was informed of a plot to be carried out against the man, I sent him to you at once. I also ordered his accusers to present to you their case against him. This is not exactly a hot potato deal where I don't want to deal with this. I'm just going to pass it on to the governor. It was protocol. The difference in Paul's situation right now is this guy believes him. And he's being sent to the most beautiful spot that we visited on the entire coast of Israel. And so the soldiers, carrying out their orders, took Paul with them during the night and brought him as far as Antipatris. And the next day, they let the cavalry go on with him, and they returned to the barracks. And when the cavalry arrived in Caesarea, they delivered the letter to the governor, and they handed Paul over to him. The governor read the letter and asked what province he was from. Learning that he was from Cilicia, he said, "I will hear your case when your accusers get here." And then he ordered that Paul be kept under guard in Herod's palace. Not the dungeon, not the prison. The King James Bible says judgment hall. But I looked the word up, and the word's primary use is palace. So, next week, we'll see that Paul spends 2 years in Herod's palace. We were there. Remember when we were there? We saw his swimming pool. We went to the snack bar and had Solero bars and walked along in the sun. And it's an incredible spot. So here Paul is taken by armed guard into protective custody and given 2 years in the most beautiful seaside resort, staying in Herod's palace, waiting for Felix to hold an inquiry involving Paul and his accusers. Why they didn't show up for 2 years, I'm not entirely sure, but we do know from looking in the next verse 27 of chapter 24 says, when 2 years had passed, they finally got around to the original reason he was put there. So let's back up. There's a lot of good stuff. There's some rabbit trails. I wanted to read the whole thing because I like for us to take things in their context. It's a lot of narrative. And we're going to spend more time on the rabbit trails than we are on the narrative. It's pretty self-explanatory, I think. The Sanhedrin, we've talked about them before, but just so that we get this on tape, a group of between 70 and 100 men at different times in Israel's history, primarily made up of noblemen. Pharisees and Sadducees were the two primary theological points of view, and they could be called extreme liberal and extreme conservative by our modern terminology. And also the chief priests were members of this body. They had absolute authority over all things religious in Israel. Even though Israel was an occupied country, the Romans gave these guys absolute authority in all but one way. What was that? You know this. Death penalty. They could not kill anybody. They were really bummed out about that. That's why they had to take Jesus before the Romans, even though they had condemned him by their own trial. The Romans wouldn't let him kill Jesus. So this is that same group of people. Paul used to be a member. It's kind of interesting, in verse 1, he addresses this body by calling them my brothers. That was against the law, unless you were a member of the Sanhedrin. Everybody else in Israel had to address members of this body by calling them father. I pointed this out last night, and a few former Catholics gasped. Do you remember in Matthew 23 when Jesus instructed his disciples to not call any religious leader on earth father? He said, don't do it. You have one father. He's the one that deserves your deference, not any earthly religious leader. Interesting that Paul calls them brothers. I'm sure that was irritating to them. It sort of took the authoritarian high ground, maybe away from them. Our first rabbit trail has to do with Paul saying, I have fulfilled my duty to God in all good conscience to this day. And our first rabbit trail is, I want to talk about conscience.